This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Folks, population numbers matter, and according to a recent report, Louisiana is amongst the fastest shrinking states in the nation, outpacing more than 40 other states in population decline. And here to talk to us about it is Lamar Gardier, Executive Director of the Data Center. Lamar, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Happy to be here.
So, Lamar, if you would give us a quick update as to what this most recent report actually states.
Yeah, so very quickly, it's suggesting that Louisiana is having a hard time maintaining population growth, plain and simply. There are some factors that prevent us from growing from the death and birth side of things to the in-migration, out-migration side of things. In fact, Louisiana ranks pretty high in the negative factors for both of those circumstances.
Such as?
So, you know, population change has two components, as I said. It's births minus deaths, and it's in-migration minus out-migration. And, you know, the in-migration versus out-migration thing normally gets the most attention from folks, but the birth minus deaths is really important. The U.S. had about 8% more births than deaths in 2020, or since 2020. During that same time period, Louisiana had only 2% more births than deaths. You know, the funny thing about that, though, is that Louisiana is the 14th youngest state, which suggests that we aren't having a problem with the number of births. We're having a problem with the number of deaths that we have here in Louisiana. Louisiana does have one of the highest age-adjusted death rates of all states.
And, I mean, that's, I know almost my entire life we have been at the top of that chart, as yes. I recall. I don't think it's ever, I don't think it's much changed, no matter what effort we've made, right?
Yeah. Yeah, certainly we've been, I think, for different factors near the top of that list. You know, recently there are a few things that really come to mind. Louisiana is has the fourth highest drug overdose death rate in the nation in 2021. We had one of the highest pregnancy-related death rates in the nation. We also have high numbers of deaths from firearm suicides, you know, higher than the national average. And when you put those things together along with other health-oriented risk factors, that pushes us up to the top of the list. In fact, we have the fifth highest death rate in the nation in terms of deaths.
We're also very high with drug and alcohol abuse as well as mental health challenges, right?
Yeah. So I think being the fourth highest drug overdose death really speaks to that. These are largely deaths of despair where people are getting into bad situations, bad circumstances in life, having difficulty and you know, perhaps turning to substances that ultimately lead to their death. We know that the opioid epidemic has been a significant challenge across the country, but it's hit Louisiana pretty hard.
So when we think about, you know, these contributors, I mean, from an operational standpoint, it's difficult to turn the tide, right, in this trend. I mean, there's no panacea solution to turn this around. And when you add to this high car insurance rates, high homeowners rates, flood rates that are insurance rates that may be undeterminable, and we're probably looking at more increases there on top of it, and the fact that our public education system has failed us for decades and that the vast majority of people that can sacrifice and make it ends meet send their kids to private and parochial schools.
Wow, you brought up a lot of important issues in that one comment. So let me try to talk about a few of them. So on the births and deaths side again, that's one of those things where you can really look to other states in terms of what they've done to decrease the number of deaths, you know, for overdoses or for pregnancy-related deaths, so on and so forth, firearms deaths. And we can follow some of the models in other states to bring down the number of deaths in those spaces. You know, it takes a certain set of resources and long-term commitment to those things. But there are models across the state, across the country, rather, where if we adopt it, we could bring down those death rates, which would help us in terms of population change long-term. You mentioned a number of economic factors, though, and these are the ones that are quite a bit harder to adjust quickly, because what works in one state isn't necessarily going to work in another state. Louisiana is one of 15 states that had more out-migration than in-migration, and we ranked sixth among those states, which essentially means that we didn't have enough people coming into the state for the number of people that left. In fact, for every 10 Louisiana residents who moved to another state, only 7 residents came in. And when we talk about this, you know, I think when we talk anecdotally in our communities and to friends and things like that, folks point to all kinds of reasons why people would be leaving an area or a state. You might look at crime rates or quality of life or flooding or insurance and things like that. And certainly there are probably some people that made that choice, but by and large, there are two reasons that people move long distance. In other words, leave a state for another state. And that's work opportunities and social networks or family-related reasons. And the work opportunities piece is really where we see weakness in Louisiana.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, it's really kind of a mishmash of a bunch of different things that are coming together. Obviously, I think that the new administration and the past administration were closely paying attention to this out-migration versus in-migration, mm-hmm. because I think one of the other troubling considerations of that data point is that the out-migration are higher wage earners, the in-migration are lower wage earners, and anytime you're upside down that way, that makes that situation that's already a problem even more problematic, right?
Well, I'm not quite sure if I would characterize it like that. I honestly don't have the data in front of me to speak to that authoritatively. In fact, we know that Louisiana's population, or rather its economy's number of jobs, tends to move up and down with the oil industry, which is typically a volatile industry. But those are often pretty well-paying jobs. It's just that they're inconsistent. And because the oil and gas industry is a legacy industry, as it moves forward, it's looking for additional efficiencies. And one of the ways to be more efficient is to decrease its workforce. So even though, you know, we move up and down with the oil industry, it's shedding jobs slowly over time as it gets more efficient. You can look from 2000 on to current times, and Louisiana has only added 2% more jobs since 2000. And, you know, by comparison, the United States earned 18% or increased their jobs by 18% over that same time period. So we significantly lag behind the rest of the country in terms of job growth. We really only look to oil and gas, honestly, to have significant growth in this in Louisiana. We certainly need to find ways to diversify and add other important, particularly professional industries to our state.
Absolutely. If you had, you know, if someone came to you and said, Lamar, give me the wish list of what you think first and foremost we should do, what would you suggest?
I would suggest the same thing you suggested in your earlier comment, that we put significantly more resources behind education. That is, in higher education, ensure that our folks can go to the wonderful state schools that are in our state, that folks in the K-12 process are able to be educated in a way that makes them, that allows them to be effective in their higher education. We could significantly increase our funding to help early childhood education. And we've done some work in that space, but much more needs to be done. We need higher wages for teachers so we're able to attract more teachers, innovative teachers to our region. We have one of the drivers behind our lackluster education system is child poverty. We've had high child poverty rates in Louisiana for a very, very long time. And it is, in fact, child poverty that is one of the most important reasons that education is less effective than it could be. I know we have a lot of different experiments in terms of charter schools and school choice and things like that, but all of those things struggle to be effective if children are indeed trying to be educated through poverty. You could significantly improve educational outcomes simply by making sure a child is able to be educated without also having to worry about poverty. And there are some tactics that we have access to pretty immediately that could reduce child poverty in a great way in our states. They take revenue and things like that, but it's that kind of commitment to both children through child poverty, through eradication of child poverty, and to young folks as they develop through education, that if I had a magic wand and a wish list, I would add just a crazy amount of resources into those things, because that's where our future is going to be, and that's where that's how we're going to make our state attractive to businesses and to other folks to be a place where they want to live and to help grow in terms of additional jobs coming to our state.
Lamar, do you think we don't spend a lot of time talking about skilled trades. There are shortages, mm-hmm. not only here in this state, but across the country. Do you ever get the sense that there may be a resurgence there? I mean, the folks that are working in skilled trades are making good wages. A lot of them can set their own schedules. There's a lot more flexibility. They could be a lot more nimble. There's so many positives to that, but you just don't see this yearn of young adults wanting to go into the skilled trades.
No, there's a lot of effort and attention to increasing the number of people who are qualified for these kinds of jobs through workforce development programs and things like that. We think about pipe fitters and welders, plumbers, electricians, things like that, always a need for these folks. And there's a lot of effort, right, to increase the number of people in that space, particularly as you see the number of men declining in college enrollment. It's the phenomenon that's happening across the country. We see just slides, downward slides in the number of men graduating from college or even going to college. And that's a significant problem that we have to address locally and we have to address in this country, because our economy is developing in a way where increasingly a college education is what is needed. Even if you are in one of those skilled trade jobs, one of the ways that you get access to that flexibility is by owning a business, right? I'm an independent electrician, an independent plumber, or I have a small practice. But those things often require a set of skills that go beyond what you would learn in terms of just doing the trade, right? So college education is going to be important even in those situations as well. The other piece about the skilled trades is that these are jobs that are not always available or easily transferable. Now, what I mean is if you are a pipe fitter and you're doing the work, but the company downsizes and you don't, or the opportunities out there are just diminished, and so there are layoffs, there aren't always a lot of places you can turn to apply that skill set very quickly for employment. And so you end up having to move somewhere else, or you try to retrain, but it takes a while to retrain. That's a little different from having a college degree, which is often a set of transferable skills that give you access to a wider range of industries. I think folks are often left in a lurch when some of those skill trade jobs that they've those blue collar skill trade jobs in particular that they've trained for and that they depended on suddenly leave a region. And this is what we've seen across the significant parts of the country, right across the Rust Belt and parts of Appalachia, parts of like Michigan and Pennsylvania, things like that. But also here in the South, we've seen this same phenomenon where people were expecting to be able to get access to certain jobs that don't require college education and had them for a bit. But when the industries left, our population was left in the lurch. So, you know, while we certainly should focus on those kinds of opportunities because they're there, it's still important to make sure people are getting access to four-year degrees because that's where our economy is going long term.
And you always have to have your finger on the pulse of what's happening, right? I mean, if I walk into a type of employment, in today's world, there's no guarantee that that's going to be there 30 years from today, right? Technology's changing. The way we receive information is changing. Things are ever changing. The thought process of going to one company, staying there 40 years, drawing your retirement, and living life happily ever after, would suspect and suggest that those days are pretty much gone. You have to constantly refine, re-engineer oneself to not make yourself as dispensable, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that supports the idea that the four-year degree is what gives you that level of flexibility. There are, you know, many folks who were perhaps an English major, but now they're in web design, right? Or they were in an art history major, but now they're in the data world. You know, and I'm giving these examples because I've hired people with these skill sets, with these college degrees before, but who could successfully apply them to other areas that were fast-paced, really one of the future-looking types of jobs. There's that flexibility that you have from a four-year degree allows you to very quickly pivot in a lot of cases to the jobs that are available in your region that are coming online now as we progress through time and have an ever more service-oriented economy. Those things do transfer pretty well, and in some cases transfer better than the vocational skills that you picked up for some of those jobs we just mentioned earlier.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. I happened to be talking to some young doctors not too long ago about the future of medicine and where, what field should young med students pick out where they're going? And he says, well, it's pretty simple. If you want to last in this business, you're going to go into a discipline within medicine where you can't be replaced by a machine because the technology's coming. It's growing fast. So, there has to be, if you want longevity in that field, you want to pick one of the disciplines that you're indispensable. I mean, you're not going to be replaced by a machine. And I think, the folks that are spending a lot of time educating themselves and these challenges are really and I think a lot greater in these high performing sectors of the economy than in others, because you're very limited as to what your options are without having to go backwards. Right.
Yeah, I think that's a great point as well. Automation is, as I mentioned earlier, in some of those legacy industries, right, where they're looking for efficiencies, and sometimes that efficiency comes from automation, right, where the workforce is decreased.
But more often than not.
Yeah, there's technology that allows for the same job to be done with fewer people. Now, the argument about that might be, well, it's not as many jobs being lost because somebody still needs to operate the machine, right? And that's true, but it typically takes fewer people to operate those machines. And just because you knew how to do the manual process doesn't mean you're going to be great at operating the machine or maintaining the machine, right? Which is, again, the reason for the need for higher level skill sets that are transferable from some of the more blue-collar oriented work to some of the more advanced technology oriented skills that would exist today. That would allow you to be the person who transitions from the line to operating one of the machines. But certainly not everybody's in position to make that kind of transition. So we do see job losses when automation happens.
Well, the opportunities are there. The question is whether one is going to, reach out and touch that opportunity, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, when you I had the chancellor from Delgado on yesterday. When you think about all of the programs that they offer and so many different variations, traditional semester, 8-week program, 12-week program, over the holiday programs, you know, in so many of the different areas to improve upon oneself and to make oneself more versatile. You know, I mean, I get frustrated when I hear folks talking and complaining and they've done nothing to make themselves more marketable, right?
Yeah.
And you always have to grow as an individual and make yourself more marketable. I mean, it's just, that's how you survive in today's business world. You cannot remain static. You have to be dynamic as to what you do. You know, it's funny, you talk to folks and you know, it comes up in the conversation that you used to work 2 or 3 jobs, and it's like, well, why did you do that? It's, well, I needed the money. You know, there was a lifestyle that I wanted, and one job wasn't going to get me there. So I worked 2 and sometimes 3 jobs, you know, and it comes at a price. There's a lot of sacrifice. You know, it took a long time to educate myself, for example, but I ultimately got to that point. I was, you know, you're always focused and you got to make yourself more marketable at every step that you take. Every day is a new day and a learning opportunity. You know, it's funny, you talk to folks and you ask them, you know, where they are in their career, and you say, do you read? Oh, yeah, I read the paper. That's it? Well, the sports page. That's all? You know, every day you've missed an opportunity to improve oneself. It's like, you know, it's like there's some very simple things. Last question, and it's a text that came in. How much of what we find ourselves in right now is because we are one of the poorest states in the country?
Well, I think that's a lot of it. If we go back to my earlier suggestion about education, us being a poor state means that we have a lot of kids who are in poverty. And if we have a lot of kids who are in poverty, then we aren't going to have good educational outcomes. If we have poor educational outcomes, we won't have high college attainment levels. If we don't have high college attainment levels, then we don't have a workforce that is attractive to the kinds of companies we would like to bring in and the kind of industries that we'd like to bring in to our state. When there are folks who don't have these kinds of advanced degrees, there's a decreased ability to be successful in entrepreneurship and other such things. And those things, you know, started off with being having a population that is too poor in terms of the children that are trying to grow up and develop in our state. And after decades and decades of that reality, it's what we're now seeing is the fruit of that disinvestment, right? Which is we have a weak economy and we don't have the level of educational attainment that other states have. And so we aren't as attractive to some other places. We are going to have to get serious about investing in people in this state, particularly in education. And without reservation, right? We've got to figure out ways to invest in all the people here. And that's really the only way to make our state more attractive and, you know, bring in the kinds of businesses that would really get our economy moving and reverse these.
I apologize. I got to get to a hard break. Lamar, appreciate your time, your insight.
No,
yeah. Have a great weekend. Thank you for joining us.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Lamar Gardier, Executive Director of the Data Center. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics, joins us. Ron, welcome to the show. Not much has changed. Polls are they're shifting almost daily. You know, and when you dig deep in some of these polls, everybody's kind of pulling out characteristics to make their case. What's your feel?
Right. Yeah, I think that's definitely true, although one thing I would point out is that the polls that have been most recently reported, and that's as of today, show, I think, some movement in the swing states towards Trump.
It's not much. It's very little. But he tends to be leading. When I say leading, in some cases it's 1 point, it's a half a point, in more swing states than Harris is leading. And one of the interesting pieces of movement we've seen, I think, over the last couple of weeks is a week or two, we were seeing poll numbers from Michigan, which is a critical state. It's part of what Democrats call their blue wall of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And a couple of weeks ago, Michigan was showing Harris ahead by anywhere from 2, 3, 4, and sometimes 5 points. But the most recent polls are showing it just about even. In fact, one or two of the recent polls show Trump ahead by a point. And a number of local politicians in Michigan, including Debbie Dingell, who's a member of Congress, someone I speak to occasionally about what's going on in Michigan, and she says that, and she said this publicly, that that Michigan is in dead heat right now, and that Harris doesn't have a lead there, and she thinks it's possible Trump's vote could be underestimated, and it's really up for grabs. So, again, this election, as it moves on, continues to look like Harris has the best chance now of winning the national popular vote. She's about 3 points ahead in the latest polls in the national popular vote. But in the swing states that will determine who will win the Electoral College, Trump has a very, very slight advantage.
What do you obviously we're the everyone talks about the October surprise. I kind of believe almost every day there's a surprise. there's so much information coming out as to what's going on. I mean, it's just it's crazy. It's hard to keep your finger on the pulse of it.
Sure. And, it's. Well, a lot of people expect the so-called October surprise to be something that's orchestrated by one side or another. Some people, think of it as being an uncontrollable event, like a foreign policy event or something like that. So it's hard to say what you mean by an October surprise. The present situation with Israel and Hezbollah has the potential of being something of an uncontrollable event because we don't know where that's going. And that could very well be a very, big event and increasingly so. So we don't know where that's going. And maybe if there is an October surprise, it could be something that's happening in terms of these foreign conflicts. Some Democrats were saying yesterday that the new Jack Smith report that came out was the October surprise. But I really don't see that, because even though there was new and some interesting information he put out, it wasn't significantly different than the kinds of things people have been hearing about Trump for years now. So I'm not sure that would be considered such a surprise.
And I don't know who's trying to figure out their strategy, but I think it hurts their position as opposed to helping their position by engaging in these timed, legal actions that are out there. They actually are making his case, right?
Yeah, I think so. And, the one time where, there were two October surprises that had the potential of affecting presidential races in somewhat modern history. One was in 1968 during the Vietnam War. Lyndon Johnson was not running for re-election. His vice president, Humphrey, was. And that race had really closed up and was up for grabs. And right before the election just a few days before, Johnson made a dramatic announcement about, you know, the negotiations with the North Vietnamese and a bombing halt and all that sort of thing. And most people thought it was the October surprise to help Humphrey. As it worked out, Humphrey still lost. So it wasn't particularly effective. One, from a standpoint of a natural disaster, was in the 2012 presidential election between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. And Mitt Romney was running a very close race with Obama, and in some of the polling was actually ahead a point or two. But then you had the big super, they call it the superstorm, that hit the East Coast and got a tremendous amount of press coverage. And the media sort of went from covering the presidential election to covering that storm, mostly in the last week before the election. And it deprived Romney of being able to continue to build his momentum. And it also gave President Obama a chance to show his executive ability in a disaster situation. And so that was an event that may have had some effect. But generally speaking, you know, if it is some orchestrated effect that's timed, you know, that looks like anyway that it's timed for political purposes, it's not going to really have much effect.
Let's pivot to the VP debate. A lot of folks talking about that. I left with the feeling that both of these candidates articulated the policy positions of their running mate better than their running mate has. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that was right, and I certainly thought that was right as it related to Trump and the Vance. I thought it was the best performance we've seen from Vance during the election. I haven't been particularly impressed with his speeches so far, but I thought he did an excellent job in that debate. And, you know, in terms of getting across what he wanted to get across. And of course, you know, Tim Walz tends to be a very likable person. And you know, he hung in there fairly well. But I do think Vance probably did better. Most of the polling is showing that he did. But, you know, is it helping the Trump's candidacy? It's hard to say. You know, on the one hand, you could look at some of the recent polls that have been done since then, and it does show a little slight bit of movement for Trump, but we don't know whether that has to do with campaigning going on in the swing states or whether it had to do with Vance's performance in the debate.
But typical for campaigns in this last, 30 days now, you want, you know, momentum builders, right? You want the positives to outweigh the negatives so that you're consistently creating momentum in order to peak on November 5th.
Sure, absolutely. And you also have to remember, too, that, you know, we have early voting going on. And early voting will be stepping up over the next few weeks. And so we've talked about this in the past, but early voting, while voters like it, I often vote early myself, but it does increase the cost of campaigning because you can't wait until the day before the election to crest. You have to crest like every day for the last month. And that takes a lot more money in campaigns. I've seen it locally, and I think the same is true in terms of a presidential race.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see over the next 30 days. Because it's funny, both of these candidates have this uncanny ability of putting their foot in their mouth. You know, and even one that's not even talking that often out there and as opposed to Trump, and then Trump on the other side, it's there are things that are coming our way that it's like, you know, you kind of grimace. You say,
yeah,
OK, let's rock and roll.
Right. Well, and that's the reason why, even though people continue to say there's no undecided, it's a 50-50 race. there are undecided voters. And what a lot of people keep forgetting is that some of the people who are for Harris and some of the people who are for Trump actually are just parked there until they find some reason to go to the other side or to get off of them. So there's still persuasion that needs to be done on a number of voters in this race. And it's not over yet. It continues to go on, even though people have started voting.
Yeah. Interesting. As always, Ron Fauché, thank you so much for your time, your insight. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
That's Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. You can just Google Lunchtime Politics and you'll find his publication that's put out, and you can sign up for it and receive it. I read it religiously. And he brings together a number of different polls and works out averages so as to not place too much importance on one or the other. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we will visit with Jay Cicero, President and CEO of Greater New Orleans Sports Foundation, as we discuss the ramp up to Super Bowl 59. We'll also visit with Leah Brown, Mike Sawaya, and Evan Holmes.